Jake Zuckerman had another winner over the weekend, a story about a fracking nightmare and the state's poor way of dealing with it. It's the first story we'll be talking about on Today in Ohio. It's the news podcast from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn, here to have a conversation with Lisa Garvin, Layla Tassi, and Laura Johnston. Layla, you get the fracking story. Fracking companies inject hazardous chemicals into the ground as part of their process. Some of that toxic stew was discovered more than a mile from one Ohio fracking site. Why did regulators block the move to stop this from happening for months so that the whole investigation could be completed?
It's kind of a mystery why regulators didn't put a stop to this sooner. There are 235 active Class II injection wells in Ohio. The ones in question, operated in Athens County by K&H Partners, house more than 30 million barrels of brine, nearly 1 billion gallons, deep underground at high pressure. The brine is the salty, potentially radioactive byproduct of oil and gas production. ODNR says some of that brine migrated to oil and gas production wells as far as a mile away. There's no evidence that the brine breached any groundwater aquifers, but ODNR warned that that's a possibility, and they're in the process of bidding out groundwater testing. But this problem has been years in the making. State regulators received reports that pointed to a potential leak as far back as May of 2019. It took 4 years to stop it. And then in October, the commission put that order on hold for another 6 months. The five commissioners didn't offer any explanation despite ODNR's concerns about irreparable harm to the groundwater in Athens County. And then finally on Friday, the Ohio Oil and Gas Commission upheld a regulatory order suspending operations of the three wells that were found to be leaking toxic waste into the surrounding area. So Tallgrass Energy is the parent company of K&H. They deny that their wells are leaking. They say their brine water is contained within its permitted zone, which is significantly deeper than any freshwater aquifers in the area, according to them, and incapable of impacting drinking water. The spokesperson did not, however, respond when Jake asked if they tested groundwater around the wells.
Well, I didn't get to talk to Jake, so I'm curious about the timing of them approving this. Like, did they prove it Friday because they knew this story was coming? This is inexcusable what they did. The state environmental people looked at this and said, "Holy moly, this is a problem. Shut it down." And then this dopey commission, which is filled with people who are in the industry, has the power to stop an order of the state administration and keep pumping this stuff in. I think it's hilarious. The company saying, "Oh, well, we inject it way deeper than that. It's under intense pressure. It can go up." The story points out where it's most likely to come up are the holes you drilled in the ground nearby. This shows just how in the bag this entire state is for the energy industry at the expense of people.
Right.
The whole idea of injecting billions of gallons of toxic chemicals into the ground, keeping secret what is in those chemicals, because we can't find that out because the legislature made that a secret deal, and destroying the future. Of course, this stuff is going to come back. The earth shifts and we're seeing it. And then when it happens, we have this commission that has the power to keep it happening because they're all in the bag of the industry. And there should be like regular people on this commission, common sense people who live in the areas to say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, we're going to keep the residents safe."
Can I chime in on this commission? Because this story made me think of a story I wrote in 2009 when the state was telling, remember when the cities themselves were trying to ban fracking within their borders, a home rule provision, and the state said, "You can't do that." So I wrote about this oil and gas commission. It's made up of an attorney, two industry representatives, a geology expert, and the public representative. And they're all appointed by Governor DeWine. So let's just point that out, that this all comes from the governor. And at the time, the public representative was a professor at Marietta College whose students took internships in the gas and oil industry. So not really a public representative. And it seemed to me crazy then, 15 years ago, that this was the people who are supposed to stand up for the citizens of Ohio. But think about what's changed in the last 15 years, the fact that we allow fracking in state parks. It doesn't surprise me that this is still the way it operates.
Now, the government has completely ransomed the future. The future generations will be dealing with this. They'll be dealing with it in the state parks. They'll be dealing with it in groundwater, all for the quick buck of getting this gas out of the ground. And even when the very weak safety issues come up, they still go past it. I can't believe this company is still saying it's not ours. Where else did the toxic stew come from if it's not from you? It's not naturally occurring in the soil.
And it's in the poorest part of the state. You know, this is Appalachian Ohio, where people don't have the power, the money, or whatever to fight this.
What is Mike DeWine doing appointing people like this to it? I also like the fact that Jake Story pointed out that the two people who represent that area, one of them is in that industry. He wouldn't talk to Jake, but his whole job is in that industry. Great story. Check it out. It's on cleveland.com. Way to go, Jake. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Why does the federal government want to transfer Ohio National Guard members into the U.S. Space Force? And, Lisa, why does Governor Mike DeWine object?
Yeah, there's a proposal by the U.S. Department of Air Force to transfer up to 600 Air National Guard personnel in Ohio and six other states to the Space Force. Now, these workers have been performing space-related jobs for nearly 30 years. They're also in Alaska, California, Colorado, Florida, Hawaii, and New York. But in a letter to the Biden administration, Governor DeWine says that that would circumvent the authority granted governors by federal law, and he wants to ensure that National Guard members can remain in the communities that they serve. Many of them are part-time. They have civilian jobs. They really don't want to have to move or go full-time, which may happen if they're transferred to the Space Force. Also, the National Governors Association is opposed. They say it denies the legitimate authority of governors as the commander-in-chief of their respective National Guards. The National Guard Association says they want to establish a Space National Guard, so it would just be another arm of the National Guard. But the Air Force Department and the White House are against that. Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall is defending this proposal. He says it would provide a unity of command in the Space Force that's necessary for optimal efficiency.
To do what? I just don't get. What are they going to do? Right now, the National Guard is our disaster relief. They're the ones that go into cities if there's unrest. I mean, we use them all the time to do very important things. They're not going into space. So what is the point of this?
I'm wondering what this point of the Space Force is, quite honestly.
I get where Mike DeWine is coming from here. He needs to have control over these guys because he's the one that sends them in. Back when Cleveland was having the unrest after the George Floyd protest, the National Guard came in, helped the depleted Cleveland police keep order for a few weeks. When we needed help getting the COVID vaccine to people, it was the National Guard that did mm-hmm. that. They were terrific. And if you start splintering them, we're not going to have that ability. I'm surprised that the Biden administration isn't buckling to this. I think Democratic and Republican governors would be up in arms. This is one of the assets they use to help people. You're listening to Today in Ohio. We know Maureen O'Connor is the longtime Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court before she retired. We know her as a leading force behind the anti-gerrymandering initiative we expect to see on the November ballot. Should we know her for work in Ukraine, Laura?
This is a big deal, and I didn't know anything about it. But Judge O'Connor is serving as the U.S. sole representative on a six-member group called the Advisory Group of Experts. That's the panel that's helping vet candidates for the top court in Ukraine, which is called the Constitutional Court of Ukraine. And they form this panel to increase the independence and trust in the judicial system. It wants to eventually join the European Union. And to do that, it has to have a fair and impartial court, which its past behavior has not shown that. So the big picture is democracy. And that's what O'Connor told Andrew Tobias, our reporter. She said, what happens in Ukraine is a direct reflection on the bolstering of democracy in the face of communism. So she was recruited for this position by USAID, which is an agency that is affiliated with the US State Department. She'd had some past experience with the country. She was asked to lecture judges in the 2000s about the American judicial system. She grew up in Parma Heights, which has a significant Ukrainian-American population. And she fit this candidate idea of legal expertise and competencies, reputation, integrity, and leadership qualities. Obviously, we know she was the chief judge. She's got this bona fides for speaking her mind and standing up for what's right. So she is working with them to try to be a good court, basically.
It was great to see. I didn't realize that she had the time because she's been so busy with the gerrymandering initiative, but this is great and helping out Ukraine. I was glad to see over the weekend that many of our House members in both parties supported the aid to Ukraine. Of course, Jim Jordan didn't. And I was happy to see Lindsey Graham take down J.D. Vance for his myopic misunderstanding of what's going on over there. But to have Maureen O'Connor working in the background on something like this as part of a small group, that's pretty cool.
Definitely.
You're listening to Today in Ohio. How is Northeast Ohio playing a role in the illegal drug trade in West Virginia? Layla, this is an odd one. Normally, it's other places that bring the drugs here.
Right. U.S. Attorney William Illenfeld in West Virginia last week announced federal drug charges against 10 Northeast Ohioans, including five each from Cleveland and Akron. And he said the northern part of his state has been getting a surge in drugs from Cleveland area residents accused of dealing cocaine and heroin. His office in recent weeks filed five separate cases that accused different groups of dealing meth, heroin, fentanyl, or cocaine in northern West Virginia. Most of the charges stem from drug deals from from February to September of 2023. So you're right. This is unusual and upsetting to know that we are contributing to the drug crisis in other places.
You wonder if the people who make money dealing illegal drugs have been so cramped here that they've decided to branch out elsewhere where they have maybe lesser law enforcement. It's not that far to go. It's part of the, getting there. You're going through a pretty open part of the state. Just not something. I don't think we've seen that before. I've been here a long time. I don't remember a similar case. You're listening to Today in Ohio. I love this story, Lisa. Does an appellate court ruling we have a right to call city workers and drop F-bombs willy-nilly if we are dissatisfied with their service?
Apparently so. So North Ridgeville resident Matthew Golga was convicted for telecommunications harassment, and he was sentenced to 180 days in jail for calling the city of North Ridgeville 8 times in 26 minutes after his water was shut off for non-payment. He cursed and screamed at the accounting clerk who tried to help, but she ended up having to end several calls because she just couldn't deal with him. So he called and left a voicemail. He dropped the F-bomb 11 times in that voicemail, and he was just, he wasn't asking for help. He was just cursing them out. And so finally, the public utilities director was able to help him, but he cursed at her too. So the Ninth Appeals Court overturned this conviction. It was not a unanimous ruling. Judge Jennifer Hensel says it was reasonable that employees felt abused, but she said that Golga didn't call to bully city workers. His statements were of one who feels threatened, and he wasn't intentionally abusing or intimidating others. And Judge Donna Carr, who also concurred, said that it was constitutionally protected speech. But in her dissent, Judge Jill Flagg Lansinger says that Golga interrupted, talked over, and screamed at the clerk despite her efforts to help, and she tried to de-escalate the situation, but she said that the tone and manner of Golga's speech showed specific intent to harass and intimidate, and she pointed out that the voicemail had no plea to help resolve the situation. He was just venting.
Yeah, when people get bad city service, they're allowed to vent. They spend a lot of money. Nobody should do what he did. You should be civil and you get further with a smile. I can't believe, though, 180-day sentence. That does seem ridiculously excessive for somebody that's calling up upset with poor service.
But you're saying it's not poor service. His water was shut off because he didn't pay his bill. And
yeah, but okay, but he feels he's wronged. So if he feels he's been wronged and he's calling the city to scream at him, does he deserve 180 days in jail? I mean,
probably not.
There seems like there ought to be a middle ground here. Like if they really did find it to be harassment, and that's a lot of phone calls in a short period of time. You know, 180 days in jail. Think about that.
Yeah, well, of course, he didn't serve it. But yes, that probably was a tad on the excessive side. But, you know, it sounds like, you know, he called her several times. She had to hang up even though she was trying to help. You know, it must have been pretty bad.
I don't know. Sounds like any given day in Chris Quinn's email box. We're listening to Today in Ohio. We talked last year about Huntington Bank closing a Cleveland branch, maybe temporarily, because of crime. But the bank kept an ATM at the site operating. Laura, is that still a neighborhood service?
Nope. Thieves stole it on Wednesday, which is just like, wah, wah. Cleveland Council President Blaine Griffin called it a horrible timing for it to happen because the people who stole it aren't hurting Huntington Bank. They're hurting the entire community. So they ripped the ATM off its wall. They bolted. Police have suspects. And on Thursday, the bank replaced the machine. Customers have begun using it. That branch opened in 2003 and it closed on February 9th. The Huntington spokesman said they're still working with the city to hope to find a solution that allows the branch to open again.
I heard from a bunch of people over the weekend who said this is a sign of just how bad things have gotten in Cleveland. First, the bank closes because of crime in the neighborhood, and then its one remaining service gets ripped out and stolen. There are people that are looking at this as kind of the doom of the city. It is a sign of the hopelessness in certain neighborhoods, but it was a striking kind of news story. It hit a lot of people that way.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. It's bad news for everybody involved, and you feel for the neighborhood, the good law-abiding citizens that live there and just want to be able to go to a bank and, you know, make their deposits. And it's too bad for everyone.
All right, Laura, keep your mic unmuted. A recent study discussed certain pollutants as contributing to dementia, so we wondered whether we have that problem in Northeast Ohio. We know we have dementia, but is it pollutants that cause it? What did we learn?
The pollutants that specifically can cause dementia are not so bad here. But I think this is a bigger idea that we don't need to clean up the environment just for the environment's sake, but also for our health. It's a study last month that said to protect yourself from dementia, you should drink less alcohol, eat less sugar, drive less, and walk more, and also protect yourself from these pollutants, including high levels of nitrogen dioxide. That was one of three modifiable factors that can also have this significant impact on your brain health. And this was news to a lot of people. We know that if you eat healthy and you exercise, that's good for your body. But this idea that air pollution is not bad for just your heart or just your lungs, it's also bad for your brain. So the Cleveland area is in pretty good shape when it comes to this nitrogen dioxide. They haven't exceeded the EPA's non-attainment standard any time over the last 10 years. That's in part because we have fewer manufacturing facilities that are putting that smoke into the air with the burning of fossil fuels. But the worst part of this comes from driving, from cars. And we do have e-check. I've got to get my 12-year-old Accord e-checked soon. That protects us from those pollutants. So that's good news. But I think the bigger issue here is everything is connected, people. The air we breathe, the health of the earth, the health of our bodies and our brains.
Yeah, the alarming parts of this, that the alcohol use was clearly connected to it. The overconsumption of sugar clearly connected to it, but the air pollution was the one that raised the question, how serious is that here? We have other air pollution problems in Cleveland with ozone, but it's not this, which was kind of good news in the end.
I think for a long time, and both my mom's parents died of Alzheimer's disease, and people just thought it was genetic, and they didn't recognize all the things that you can do to protect yourself, and not just in old age where they say, you know, do the Sudoku or, you know, learn a language or whatever to keep your brain working. It's stuff you should be doing when you're my age to protect yourself, because the more damage you're doing to your blood vessels and your neurons now, the fewer neurons you have to lose later. So you need to be thinking about this stuff when you're in your 30s and 40s and 50s before you get to that point.
And the story pointed out that's why it's so critical to get the lead out of Cleveland houses, yes, because the lead does to kids' brains exactly what all these other factors are doing to the rest of our brains, depriving them of the brain cells they need for later in life. It's a good story. You should check it out. It's on cleveland.com. Gretchen did a nice job. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Cleveland provides the water we drink in much of Northeast Ohio. What is it doing about the growing problem of forever chemicals in the water? Man, we've talked about poison in the fracking. We've talked about poison in the air. Now let's talk about our drinking water.
Yeah, Cleveland Water is going to start testing its supply for PFA, also known as forever chemicals, to comply with EPA mandates for testing for PFAs, lithium, and other unregulated chemicals, and to meet enforceable limits of these chemicals. So the testing will begin in September and it'll go through June of next year. They must remediate any levels that are above the enforceable standards. So for PFOA, which is a former ingredient of Teflon, and PFOS, which is a former Scotchgard ingredient, that limit can only be 4 parts per trillion. 3 other chemicals that we'll be measuring can only be 10 points per trillion or lower. Cleveland Water Division Commissioner Alex Margavicious, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, he said that previous testing of Lake Erie raw water and then treated water that's piped to the public has not detected forever chemicals so far. So they have 3 different methods to remove this. Cities do and water systems do. One that's probably the least expensive and will be the most used is granular activated carbon. It also removes other contaminants than PFAs. And then there's one called reverse osmosis. That's where they force water through a really thin barrier that separates the chemicals from the water. And then there's one that's known as ion exchange resins. These are tiny little beads that attract and hold these toxins and keep them out of the water. And apparently these methods are also available to customers in their homes. Customers can buy affordable home filtering systems if they wish.
But they're not finding it yet. That's really interesting.
And surprising.
Yeah, because the word had always been, it's too late. They're everywhere. And now we have to start getting them out. But they're not. And did you say they're not finding it when they take it from the lake and after they treat it?
Or? Correct. In both instances. And they take the crib, you know, where the water intake is, I think, is 3 to 4 miles offshore.
Wow, that's a great thing. If you've never taken a tour of the water plant, especially the Baldwin one, it's a cool place to walk through. It's built back in the very cool days of architecture, and it's a massive structure. You're listening to Today in Ohio. The turnaround of Cleveland's Hingetown neighborhood in recent years is remarkable, and it has become a center for all sorts of activity. Layla, what's the proposal to supercharge the vibe in that community?
Steve Litt tells us that West 29th Street at Church Avenue in the Hingetown neighborhood has become such a popular location for concerts, flea markets, dog walkers, and families with young kids that the city of Cleveland is exploring whether it makes sense to turn it into what's known as an open street. That means that they would close it to vehicles part of the time or all of the time and install amenities like street furniture. This past Saturday, city planners and consultants held a public meeting at a deli and bakery on West 29th Street to gather some public feedback on that concept, and the city has received a $100,000 grant from the Project for Public Spaces to come up with a design, to test and evaluate various kinds of street furniture, and organize events on the street for a year with installation and programs starting in the late summer, early fall. There's no design yet. The project will concentrate primarily on the block between Church and Clinton Avenues, but the city could also consider including the busy block to the north between Church and Detroit Avenues. So it's pretty exciting. I wonder what kind of feedback they got from the public.
What I liked about this story is Steve kind of took us through the history of this movement, that it became big years ago because of in Europe, it's everywhere and it's wonderful, but then it kind of petered out and fewer communities were doing it. And it's suddenly being discussed anew. I wonder why it didn't take the last time.
Yeah, I wonder too. Yeah, he said that after some plate locations installed these kinds of concepts, they started to tear them out again. And Cleveland has been a little slower to grab onto this trend, but Mayor Justin Bibb has brought it to the fore. Steve also pointed to the Van Aken District in Shaker Heights as a potential model for what this could look like. Every summer, Shaker has closed a portion of Tuttle Road near the retail and restaurants there to create an outdoor living room with picnic tables and AstroTurf. It's very temporary looking, according to the photo that he included. I think this will have a much more permanent feel if they do decide to go forward with this.
I live near Lee Road in Cleveland Heights, and I've wished they would do that there for years. Everybody says, oh, it would block traffic, it would block traffic. But we have so many east-west kind of north-south arteries that could take up the slack. I just think it would make for a wonderful kind of district. And I'm sure if you talked about it, you could come up with other areas where you'd love to see this traffic-free, roomy, kind of enjoyable place. I hope they get it done in Hingetown. It's amazing how much that neighborhood has changed in the last 20 years.
But I will say this about Hingetown, and I've only been there a couple of times. It's kind of hard to navigate, you know, because a lot of streets dead end and some of them are one way and they're really, really narrow. And I'm wondering if you're cutting off access to, you know, to Detroit, you know, then they're going to bleed onto other streets. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
I just, when you go to Europe, and you're in districts that have this, they're wonderful, and people seem to thrive in them. We're such a car-based culture, though, that I think it must be harder to pull off. Because if you want to go there, of course, like you said, Lisa, you got to get there, you got to find a place to park, and that can be very challenging.
Well, it's hard to park anywhere around Ohio City and Hingetown. Yes. I don't know that closing one street is going to make a huge difference, but I was in Traverse City a couple of years ago, and they closed down blocks of their main street with the stores on either side and the restaurants. And I don't know if it's year round or if it's just in the summer, but it was so nice to not have to worry about, you know, holding your kid's hand super tight to make sure they don't get hit by a car. But that's what the story talked about, that families are moving to Hingetown. And this sounds like a delightful way to spend an evening.
Right. Well, when you sit outside in any of the shops on Lee Road in Cleveland Heights, you know, buses are going by. You're never that far from the vehicular traffic, and it doesn't have that peaceful feeling you get in a true district like this. It'd be a good experiment. As usual, Steve does a very thorough job in laying out how it worked, what it would mean, and the whole history. Our readers love Steve Litt, and there's a reason for that. You're listening to Today in Ohio. That's it for Monday. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Layla. Thanks, Laura. Thanks to everybody who listens. Come on back Tuesday for another discussion of the news.